In the heart of Bangkok, on a corner I know well, traditional Thai dancers in brilliant silk costumes and gilded crowns dance before a statue of the Hindu god Brahma. Chinese tourists pay for the dancers' chanted blessing. They kneel a minute or two, get tapped on the shoulder with an "okay, finished," and move on to make way for the next paying customer. The story goes that this shrine was built back in the 1950s to counteract the bad karma from laying the foundation of the nearby Irrawaddy Hotel on an inauspicious date. When I lived in Bangkok in the early 90s, the Irrawaddy Shrine was seen as a place of luck. Vendors sold lottery tickets just outside its gates. People came to pray for good fortune in their lives. Taxi drivers would take their hands off the steering wheel and put them together in a Thai gesture of respect or reverence. Sitting in the back seat, I would silently wonder about the luck of taxi drivers who take their hands off the wheel in busy intersections. Thailand back then was enjoying a stretch of good luck, certainly in relative terms. Bad luck had fallen to many of its neighbors. There was war and then isolation under communist rule in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, isolation under a superstitious strongman in Burma, instability in the Philippines, corruption and nepotism in Indonesia. By comparison, Thailand was looking pretty good. So investors and tourists poured in, and economic growth soared. A lot has happened since then, to Thailand, to the region, and to the region's place in the world. China's more powerful and more assertive. Indonesia is now a democracy. Vietnam's economy is booming, and Myanmar's and Cambodia's are coming up fast. They're growing faster than China's and faster than Thailand's. Thailand has had more than a decade of political turbulence and occasional violence, including gunfire on the streets, including right here, right around this shrine. Then came a coup, and now Thailand's never exactly deeply rooted democracy is on its heels. The military government is bringing in people who criticize it for a few days of what it calls attitude adjustment. Censorship is rife. The revered king is now 88 years old, and Thailand's political future is uncertain. And in a particularly inauspicious sign, at this beloved shrine last August, an explosion killed 20 people and injured 120 more. Thai authorities say the attackers were Uyghur Muslims from China, retaliating for the Thai government sending back to China a group of Uyghur men who'd been trying to flee China. The Thai military wants to stay on China's good side. The Uyghurs, the theory goes, wanted to hit a target that would pack an emotional punch. Still, in Thailand, something and its opposite can be true at the same time, and often is. So, last New Year's Eve, Thailand joined 9 other Southeast Asian nations in agreeing to form a single market with the aim of becoming a major global player in this century. There's great promise, there are big challenges, and luck no longer seems to have much to do with it. This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. There's a word in Thai for fun, sanuk. Life is built around it. And these friends at a Bangkok dinner party are having it. And if you want a positive vision of what Thailand's future could be, this is a good place to start. Many of those here are in their 20s and 30s. They've come back to Thailand after years abroad at top schools and working for leading companies in the United States and beyond. They've come back because they see potential here.
I was with Ashoka Foundation for a year, and then I was at ideal.org in San Francisco, and they use design thinking. Yeah, and I had worked in Bhutan in education for a year, and before that I was at Stanford.
This is Virya Vichitvadakan. She's now running the Social Innovation Lab at Thammasat University's School for Global Studies in Bangkok.
You know, we have social innovation projects, we connect students to internship, we bring in guest speakers to immerse students and sort of guide students with different career paths in the we call it impact sector, but just like if you can make an impact in different areas, like it could be in corporate, international development, NGOs.
Another Thai woman at the table listens quietly with a slight smile. She's petite, with a ponytail, and could pass for a college student, though she's in her early 30s. Others defer to her. One explains that she was in the U.S. Army for 7 years. She used to fly Blackhawks, including during a 15-month stint in Iraq.
You know, it was quite an experience. I think it's definitely a transformational experience.
Pearl Pavisad was born in Chicago to Thai parents. She grew up both in Thailand and the U.S. and went to West Point.
I guess you feel like as a soldier you train to go to war. So if you don't go, I think there's always a feeling of, did I do everything that, you know, I was supposed to? And I think when I was in the Army, we were fighting two wars. So in one sense, you know, I'm proud that I got a chance to serve. But looking at the situation, the geopolitical situation there right now, I mean, there's always that question of, did we really make a difference there? You know, were my efforts, you know, beyond serving my country, and, you know, were my efforts really worthwhile? And were the lives of people who died, or not just died, but maimed, you know, psychologically, physically, was that worth it? You know, I think there's always that question.
Pearl holds both U.S. and Thai passports, and after serving one of her countries, she decided to come back and serve the other, as program director of Thammasat University's new four-year BA program called Global Studies in Social Entrepreneurship.
And we're looking for leaders, change makers, and social entrepreneurs. So we search all over Thailand. We look all over ASEAN, I would say, and we also have a global perspective. So we have students from the U.S. and Europe.
Which sounds great, right? Like, just what a modern economy needs to succeed in this century. Even better with the opportunities afforded by the new Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, economic community. President Obama is taking this community seriously. He hosted ASEAN leaders in February at Sunnylands in California, the same place where he'd met with Chinese President Xi Jinping back in 2013. The symbolism was probably not coincidental. The message was that Southeast Asia matters to the United States, as U.S. Trade Representative Michael Froman said at a conference in San Francisco shortly after the Sunnylands gathering.
President Obama has made strengthening ties and cementing America's engagement in Asia a top priority. He's made 7 separate visits to the ASEAN region, more than twice the number of any previous president. This past November, we elevated our partnership to the strategic level. And at the core of that strategic partnership is a shared vision for a peaceful, prosperous Asia-Pacific region that offers security, opportunity, and dignity to all of its citizens.
Froman called the creation of the ASEAN Economic Community a major accomplishment.
Linking 10 ASEAN nations with 625 million-plus consumers. It advances ASEAN's goal of creating a single market and production base. And at a time of economic uncertainty, the AEC reminds us that a positive, pro-growth role that trade can play. It's an important signal that ASEAN is committed to being an open, rules-based regional economy that is globally competitive.
Froman was speaking at a conference organized by the U.S. ASEAN Business Council. He said even before the ASEAN Economic Community was created, ASEAN nations collectively were the United States' 4th largest trading partner, ahead of Japan. And there's more U.S. direct investment in ASEAN countries than in Japan, Korea, and China combined. But if this is already true, without any new economic community, why create one? Especially one that doesn't seek to go as far as the European Union in terms of bringing down borders and having a common currency. Malaysia's Minister of International Trade and Industry, Mustafa Mohamed, shared some thoughts at the conference.
In the context of the present volatile environment, you know, there's volatility everywhere, peace, security, stability, these are issues in many parts of the world. I think we remain an oasis of stability, young, dynamic population, very ambitious. You know, we want to do more for our people. We want to create more jobs, better quality jobs.
So the idea is to have less protectionism, a freer flow of labor amongst ASEAN nations, and an enticing environment for foreign investors, stable, peaceful, efficient. Indonesia's president, Joko Widodo, said at the same conference that his government is trying to move in that direction.
But I'm not satisfied. Please understand that we are still only at the beginning. We will continue to simplify, continue to open up, continue to modernize our rules and regulations. To quote that famous ex-California governor, there are still many excessive permits, licenses, and restrictions, to which we will say, hasta la vista, baby.
There's one thing that speakers at the conference didn't say in so many words.
China is the elephant in the room, so we have to deal with it.
This is Gawi Chonkitavon. He's a senior Thai journalist, editor, and analyst who I've known, respected, and appreciated since the late 80s, when we were both reporting throughout Southeast Asia. Gawi speaks Chinese and has lived and worked in China. And briefly, a couple of decades ago, he also worked for ASEAN.
Of course, China factor is permeated in all sphere of ASEAN's existence, whether it's cultural or economic.
So the backstory, quickly. ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, was formed during the Vietnam War as a way to prevent war among its members. Originally, these were Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, Singapore, and Thailand. Then came Brunei, and years later, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, and finally, Myanmar. There are various ASEAN gatherings every year at multiple levels, economic and political. Lots of gatherings. In fact, some people dismiss ASEAN as a talking shop that does little else. But talking rather than fighting is something. And here's something else. When ASEAN was formed in 1967, China, then under Mao Zedong, was funding communist insurgencies in almost every Southeast Asian nation. And many Southeast Asians looked at China with anxiety. Then China started to open up. The millions of ethnic Chinese in Southeast Asia helped connect their adopted homes with their ancestral home, and everybody profited. ASEAN, in its meetings, started to loop in China, Japan, and South Korea. Inclusive prosperity, why not? And then came another turn. China's growth started to go to its leaders' heads, and they got a little too pushy with their neighbors. Emblematic of that was a now infamous line from the then Chinese Foreign Minister Yang Jiechi in 2010. He said, China is a big country and other countries are small countries, and that's just a fact. Not exactly China's best moment in diplomacy. ASEAN started to look for ways to protect its interests and its independence. They embraced President Obama's pivot back to Asia.
Competition between China and United States is very real and is getting more assertive, not only through rhetoric, but through actions. And you look at trade policy, America has been very accommodative with Malaysia and Vietnam to entice them to become the founding member of TPP. And unfortunately, Thailand did not make that decision because of the domestic turmoil, which was very unfortunate because in 2003, Thailand was on a fast track to negotiate free trade zone with America after 2 years it fall flat and collapsed. The competition between U.S. and China currently actually give a very good opportunity for ASEAN to up its ante in terms of political and economic matters. So ASEAN actually has more bargaining power vis-a-vis the U.S. and vis-a-vis China, and I would add Russia also.
But ASEAN also has its challenges in presenting itself as a genuine, unified economic community. It's hard to separate economics and politics, especially as related to rule of law, free speech, and transparency. And ASEAN has a long tradition of not interfering with each other's internal political affairs and very different governing styles.
Actually, Southeast Asia, ASEAN is a miniature of Disneyland of political culture. You have absolute monarchy like the Sultan, Brunei.
In Brunei, yeah.
Yeah, and then you have a constitutional a monarchy like Thailand, you have one man show like in Cambodia, 32 years, my goodness, you know, and then you have one party rule. What is the difference between communist one party rules and AMNO or PAP of Singapore, Malaysia? Or same, they have continuity, stabilities, you know, that everybody say, hey, let's invest there, you know, and Thailand, who knows what the next day, you know, would happen.
Who knows indeed? When I was in Bangkok in March, I walked from the Erawan Shrine to the nearby Foreign Correspondents Club of Thailand to see how old friends who have been covering the region for decades feel about Thailand's prospects these days. Many were gloomy. They talked about increasing repression from the military government, increasing tension between the urban elites and the rural poor. This year, for instance, the government has told farmers up north that because there's a drought and Bangkok needs its water, the farmers can't grow a second crop this year. The second crop is what many farmers rely on for cash. This is cutting into farmers' livelihoods. Not surprising, then, that they preferred the subsidies from billionaire Thaksin Shinawat when he was in power, and then from his sister Yingluck Shinawat, who was more recently prime minister, but seen as her exiled brother's proxy. Both were ousted. Both were seen by the Thai pro-royal establishment and their supporters as trying to bring down the existing order and monopolize power for themselves. In fact, the unrest of the past decade has pitted these two groups against each other. Thaksin's red shirts, so-called because of the colors they wore in demonstrations, and the pro-monarchy yellow shirts. The tension has mounted as King Bhumibol has grown older and ailing, and a transition to a new royal generation draws nearer. There have been long-held mixed feelings in elite circles and in the general population about the crown prince. And even the Thai military is said to be split about whether to support him as Thailand's next monarch or his more widely beloved sister, the crown princess. Thailand's current military leader, General Prayut Chan-o-cha, supports the crown prince. So this is a subject that Thais talk about gingerly, if they talk publicly about it at all. Because Thailand has a lèse majesté law, you can be thrown in prison for disrespecting the royal family. But Pearl, the Thai-American former Black Hawk pilot, says she does think the 21st century presents challenges for Thailand.
Because I think a lot of the structures are falling apart.
What kinds of structures?
Well, you know, in Thailand, we hold a few things near and dear. You have Buddhism, you have the nation, whatever, however you would define the nation, you know, patriotism or something, and you have the monarchy. And I think there's everything changes, meaning what we've had in the past many, many years may not be the case in the future. So I think people who have a mindset that is, I guess, closed or, you know, very much attached to traditional ways that may be not consistent with the way things are going. I think that's going to be hard for them. I'll give you an example. Organizations in Thailand, you know, traditionally very, very hierarchical. Some would say bureaucratic. I don't know if they're going to survive when the times change, when you have LinkedIn, when talent can flow easily, when AEC becomes more of a thing. Because the people who maybe used to have to work in those organizations, maybe they won't have to in the future. And so when you have this kind of a brain drain within an organization, it's possible that it won't run. You know, it will not be sustainable. And I think that's where things could be difficult.
I also checked in with an old friend of mine, an Australian journalist named Ron Corbin. We met in a little cafe across the street from the U.S. ambassador's residence, a century-old white villa on lush green grounds, a reminder of the outsized influence the United States has long had with Thailand, certainly since the Vietnam War. But now, Thailand, like so much of the region, is opening up to more opportunities in Asia while facing challenges at home.
You know, Thailand for a long time has been undergoing changes in its economic centres, and has meant there's been, you know, just greater empowerment of people up country as the regional economies up countries or provincial economies have grown. There's now less reliance on the centre to some extent. You've got greater interaction between northeastern economies with Cambodia and Laos, so they have their own, you know, economic centres. There's a transition in the shift of power, and there's also just a failure by governments to acknowledge, the governments here in Bangkok, at all levels, every level, to decentralise. Now, if they decentralise, a lot of these problems would go away. But there's this desire to keep control in the capital, and it's having terrible effects. And it's holding the country back, from water management to the situation in the southern provinces, border provinces, where there's been an insurgency for, you know, since 2004 in the latest batch. Political devolution would solve a lot of the problems, would ease a lot of the tensions in the country. And they refuse to do that.
What's behind that? Is it sort of a lack of trust, a lack of respect, something else?
The whole country is very much caught up with the current transition, this important historical transition. And at the moment, the way is very unclear. There's a new constitution. They're going through the necessary steps to create a political framework for the future. But until there's a resolution with this transition within the monarchy itself, that leaves a great deal of uncertainty in the country.
If you were to cast forward 5 or 10 years, I mean, obviously there may be some turbulence coming up in the shorter-term future. But knowing everything you know about Thailand and the younger generation coming up here, the potential there, where would you see Thailand being sort of in the firmament of ASEAN compared to where it is now?
Crucially, the answer to that is how they deal with the next 2 to 3, 4 years in terms of the transition in the country. And whether, because there's been perhaps there's a creation of some sort of vacuum of influence, and how that is filled, and how, for instance, the institution of the monarchy moves forward, and how that's seen in the eyes of people, if they're able to balance the various elements within the monarchy, how that transition is felt by the greater community is hard to say. But the other issue is, however one might view the former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat, he tapped into a well of demands, of political demands, within people in the provincial regions. It's not going to go away and has to be met. And this is especially so for, you know, middle and working class people in the city, and for the middle class, the rising middle class in the regional centres, that don't necessarily hold the same values as the middle class in Bangkok. And it's all about the need to meet demands and aspirations of an economy that's changed significantly from one of 10 or 15 years ago. This is what this government has to understand. The country has changed. How it comes out from all of this is very difficult to say. Some people are pessimistic. Some people are also say the Thais are very pragmatic and have always been so. When faced with a crisis, they may do that again. And everyone will say, oh, well, yes, that's the Thais. They're very pragmatic.
So let's zoom way back out. Thailand's just one of 10 countries in ASEAN. Each country has its challenges, some a lot more than others. There are also wildly different standards of living. Singapore has about the same per capita GDP as the United States. Cambodia, Laos, and Myanmar's per capita GDP levels are each around a couple $1,000s a year. Even with all the goodwill in the world, how do you unite such disparate countries and economies into a cohesive economic community that will really make a difference in the world? Well, slowly, and with considerable investment in education and infrastructure linking the region. There are several efforts afoot to build roads and railways and other infrastructure, some funded by ASEAN countries, some by China, though far more is needed. And here, Thailand's luck might just give it an edge once more. Its luck is to be geographically in the center of the mainland ASEAN region. I chatted at the ASEAN conference in San Francisco with Thailand's Minister of Industry, Achika Sibunrong.
We would like to position ourselves as a gateway to our neighboring countries, and that's why the government is now trying to improve our infrastructure. We come up with a $53 billion US dollars plan to invest in the new or in the railways road or the improvement of the existing ones, and even the port and airport link with the neighboring countries. The government also set up special economic zone at the borders area, and this will help facilitating trade investment with our neighbors.
I mean, Thailand for a long time was one of the leading economies in ASEAN. But, you know, I mean, Vietnam's coming up fast. Indonesia certainly has a lot of ambition. If you cast forward 10 years, what do you think it's going to look like?
That's why at the moment we're also trying to move forward, because we cannot stand still, otherwise we'll be behind soon. So that's, I mentioned that, you know, the government has announced the special economic zone. The idea is to encourage investment in the high-tech areas. We have target 10 industries, 5 of which are the industries that we already very good at, automotive, electronic, agro industry, food industry, and tourist-related industries. But we also try to encourage new investment in the new industries, such as automation, robots, medical hub, aviation, even digital and bio and chemical and also energy. So these are the sectors that we are trying to encourage new investment. And that's the reason why I'm in the U.S. at the moment.
I'm going to be a skeptic here for a minute. If I'm an American investor and I've read about political unrest in Thailand over the recent years, and I'm a little wary, like, I don't know, I mean, if that's where I want to put my money, what would you say?
Oh, that's not what I'm dealing with American companies in Thailand, because they're doing very well and they're expanding. The government has come with a very attractive investment package. So if the American don't come, there will be companies from other countries that are coming anyway.
But not everyone looking at Thailand's prospects at the dawn of the ASEAN economic community is so enthused, because actually, the ASEAN economic community is not the only game in town. There's a lot going on all at once in Asia. There's the Chinese-run Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and its somewhat clumsily named One Belt, One Road initiative to build infrastructure across the region. Then there's the U.S.-led Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is trying to favor U.S. influence in the region. 4 ASEAN countries belong to that: Malaysia, Singapore, Brunei, and Vietnam. Thailand does not. Deborah Elms, who runs the Asian Trade Center in Singapore, thinks that makes investing in Thailand look a lot less attractive.
If I were advising an investor, I would say, why would you go to Thailand? Because for me, the benefits of Vietnam post-TPP are so significant that, particularly as an American investor, I would say that's crazy. Thailand still has an ecosystem in some sectors that is far superior to what you have available yet in Vietnam. So for some sectors like auto parts, Thailand can still continue to power on and probably will be okay, but it's getting increasingly difficult for foreign investors to operate there. The uncertainty, the political uncertainty, the cost of doing business, infrastructure challenges, Thai customs causes delays and expense for companies. Increasingly, companies are questioning, why are we still in Thailand? Why would we stay here? Why don't we move over to Malaysia, which also has an auto industry? Why couldn't we move to Vietnam and start something new? And I think smarter companies are starting to rethink some of these assumptions that they've had, and we'll see some future investment going in different places across ASEAN.
So what do you think the chances are that the ASEAN economic community push to unify standards and bring everyone to the same level will have a positive effect on the business environment in Thailand?
Well, my hope is that the non-TPP members in particular will say, we don't want to join the TPP, we're not ready, we're not able. But that's okay, because we have already in place this process called ASEAN, which we've been working on for a very long time, and we can seize the opportunity in ASEAN to use similar kinds of standards, products, procedures, etc., and over time ratchet our own policies forward in the right direction. And so we don't have to join TPP. But we can use ASEAN as the lever to put in place domestic level policy reforms to get us closer to where we need to go.
That's just one of several competing visions for the role Southeast Asia will play in this century. China would like to see it as its backyard. India is interested in getting more closely connected. After all, most Southeast Asian nations draw some of their culture, religion, or language from India, not to mention that India, the other Asian giant, is an appealing alternative partner, since it's historically shown no interest in projecting political or military power onto the region. ASEAN, as ever, is interested in dancing with all partners, as long as ASEAN's interests come first. Back at the Bangkok dinner party, Virya, the one who worked at Ashoka and IDEO.org, says she thinks the ASEAN economic community just might give Thailand the nudge it needs.
I actually think we would thrive more competitively. Like, I'm just thinking about, you know, if there's mobilization in terms of skills, cultural, and then we could have the same and similar opportunities, and it's like a bit like fought for. I mean both competition and collaboration, it could be very exciting, because I think that's when you innovate, when there's like a lot of constraints and you want to sort of make things happen. You know, I'm excited about the vision, but then I'm also about a little bit skeptical about how it's going to pan out. Yeah, so it's like hard. It's like, you know, there's a vision and it looks fine, but like, what does that happen in the implementation, or if it really serves the purpose?
All around Southeast Asia, a new globalized generation is waiting to find out, and they will almost certainly be a big part of the answer. That's our podcast. For more on this and other episodes, check out our webpage, pri.org/century. You can also listen and subscribe to Whose Century Is It on iTunes and on most other podcast apps. I tweet at Mary Kay Magstad, that's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. And if you've got comments or suggestions for future podcasts, I'd love to hear them. Send me a note on Twitter. Whose Century Is It is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's sponsored by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. I'll be back in a couple of weeks with another episode. Come on back and listen in.